Each of us has memories about mothers, or memories about the person in our life who had the role of being our mother. And I've gathered a selection of stories about this. I'm going to read to you five stories about good enough mothers. These stories are not the warm, idealized stories that are often told on Mother's Day. They are stories about some of the many mistakes that mothers have made. Yet, in spite of these imperfections, each of the children in the stories grew up to be successful published writers and respected citizens. Each of these stories describes imperfect mothers who were nevertheless good enough parents. Angela, in the book Angela's Ashes, is Frank McCord's mother. Early in the book, Frank McCord writes about being in a play yard in Brooklyn in the 1930s with his younger brother, Malachi. At the time of the story, Frank says that he's about 3 years old, and Malachi is 2 years old. The two boys are in a play yard on a seesaw, up and down, up and down. Malachi goes up. Frank, at this point, at three, Malachi is up on the seesaw, decides he's had enough, and he gets off. Malachi goes down suddenly. The seesaw hits the ground. Malachi screams. His hand is on his mouth, the two-year-old. There's blood. Oh, God, the three-year-old Frank thinks. Blood is bad. His mother will kill him. She runs across the play yard and she says to Frank, "What did you do? What did you do to the child?" Frank doesn't know what to say. He does not know what he did. She pulls his ear. "Go home. Go to bed." Bed? In the middle of the day? She pushes Frank towards the playground gate. "Go." She picks up Malachi and walks off. The apartment is empty, and Frank wanders between the two rooms, the bedroom and the kitchen. His father is out looking for a job, and his mother is at the hospital with Malachi. He wishes he had something to eat, but there's nothing in the icebox but cabbage leaves floating in melted ice. His father said, "Never eat anything floating in water for the rot that might be in it." Frank falls asleep on his parents' bed. And when his mother shakes him, it's nearly dark. She says, "Your little brother is going to sleep for a while. He nearly bit his tongue off and ended up with lots of stitches." Our minds are filled with fragmented memories of such events in our childhoods. Frank McCord's story reminds me of the time my own mother took me to the emergency room and of the set of stitches I received after my teeth went through my lower lip. I still have a small white scar from that five-year-old adventure. Sometimes the memories we have of our mothers are guilty memories, memories of times when we as children exploited the love of our mothers. Tobias Wolff tells such a story in his book, This Boy's Life, which is a takeoff on the magazine that we all read as boys, Boy's Life. This Boy's Life, a memoir. In 1955, 10-year-old Toby and his divorced mother were driving across Colorado to Salt Lake City to start a new life. Their Nash Rambler boiled over just after they crossed the Continental Divide. While they were waiting on the side of the road for it to cool, they heard from somewhere above them the sound of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past them into the next curve. They stared after it. "Oh, Toby," his mother said, "he's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, then faded. They drove on until they came to a place where the truck had gone off the road. Quite a few people were standing along the cliff. The truck had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. A stream of black smoke rose from the cab. Toby's mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. They stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. His mother put her arm around Toby's shoulder. And for the rest of the day, she kept looking at him, touching him, brushing back his hair. Tobias Wolff wrote, "I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs." I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable tool-leathered saddle. Each of us have our own memories of our childhoods. Sometimes an adult tried hard to care for us, but simply did not know enough to provide the right kind of help. The writer Elaine Simpson's mother died when she was just 2 months old, and Elaine Simpson's father died when she was just 5. So she was raised in New York City by her aunt, who was a teacher and a school principal. In a memoir describing her childhood, growing up with dyslexia, named Reversals, A Personal Account of Victory Over Dyslexia, Elaine Simpson wrote about how her aunt tried to help her learn to read. She said, "There seemed to be nothing I could do to please Auntie. With a feeling of impended doom, I would begin. I might get halfway through the first sentence before Auntie would say in a dry, controlled voice, 'In the context, the word cannot possibly be saw. The man saw going home.' Does that make sense to you? It must be was, W-A-S, was." 9-year-old Elaine would repeat, "The man was going home." In the next sentence, or the one after, she would meet the word again and hesitate. Had she said was before and had her aunt corrected her to say saw, or vice versa? She struggled as her dyslexic brain scrambled the order of the letters, W-A-S. Her aunt would say, "Don't tell me you don't recognize the word. I just told it to you. You're not trying. How can you be so stupid? The word is was. So often we parents want to do the right thing. For example, we want to teach our children to read. We do our best, but we do not know what is going on inside our children's heads. Another area where we parents are less than perfect is when we involve our children in our family fights. Russell Baker wrote a memoir called Growing Up, and in it he describes the power struggle between his mother and her mother-in-law, who lived across the street from each other in a small town in Virginia. It was the 1930s. His grandmother thought his mother kept the 6-year-old Russell under too much discipline. One afternoon, grandmother took him down into the cellar pantry of her house to feed him her homemade bread. Slicing a thick piece of homemade bread for each of them, she then laid on a coat of butter and then said, "You want jelly on top of it?" "Yes, ma'am, please," said little Russell. She took a jar from the shelf and removed the wax and had the knife poised when they were caught. "Russell, what are you doing in there?" His mother was silhouetted in the doorway. "Grandma's fixing me a piece of jelly bread." Russell's mother spoke to her mother-in-law. "You know I don't want him eating between meals." Her voice was trembling with anger. So was grandmother. "Are you going to tell me how to raise a boy?" "I'm telling you, I don't want him eating jelly bread between meals. He's my child, and he'll do as I tell him." "Don't you come in here and tell me how to raise children. I raised a dozen children, and not one of them ever dared raise their voice to me like you do." Little Russell cowered between them while the shouting rose, but they had forgotten him now as the accumulated bitterness came out. Finally, his mother noticed he was still standing there with the buttered bread in his hand. "I want you to stay on the other side of the road where you belong," she said to the boy. "He belongs over here just as much as he belongs over there," his grandmother exclaimed. Russell's mother started to leave, but turned at the door and said, "You can eat the buttered bread, but I don't want any jelly put on it." Grandmother jabbed her knife into the jar and smeared the bread with a thick coat of jelly, all the time glaring at the child's mother. "Eat it," she commanded. Russell waited until his mother marched out, and then he ate it while his grandmother watched. He didn't dare not to. While Russell Baker learned about power struggles watching his mother and grandmother, Annie Dillard learned about sarcasm and humor as her mother raised her in the 1950s in Pittsburgh. In her book, An American Childhood, Annie Dillard wrote, "There's a deer standing in the front hallway," Mom told Annie one quiet evening. "Really?" "No," said her mother. "I just wanted to tell you something once without you saying, 'I know.'" Annie remembers her mother having surgery on one of her eyes. On the operating table, just before she conked out, she said to the surgeon, "Will I be able to play the piano?" "Not on me," the surgeon said. "You won't pull that old joke on me." Of course, the surgeon was supposed to answer, "Yes, my dear, brave woman, you will be able to play the piano after this operation," to which Annie's mother intended to reply, "Oh, good, I've always wanted to play the piano." Annie Dillard wrote that her mother regarded the instructions on bureaucratic forms as a special opportunity. "Do you advocate the overthrow of the United States government by force or violence?" After some thought, she wrote, "Force." Annie Dillard said that her mother regarded children, even babies, as straight men. When her babies learned to crawl, Annie's mother delighted in buying them gowns with drawstrings at the bottom because she could step on the drawstring without the babies noticing. So they crawled and crawled and crawled and never got anywhere. Now, unlike Annie Dillard's mother, the mother of the writer Mark Salzman actually could play the piano. In fact, she earned money teaching piano lessons in her home. In his book, Lost in Place, which is a play on the old TV show Lost in Space, Lost in Place was the book. Mark Salzman describes how his mother embarrassed him. It was the 1960s, and 7-year-old Mark Salzman wrote NASA asking for information about how he could become an astronaut. 3 weeks later, he received a large manila envelope from NASA stuffed with color photos. Mark began his astronaut training immediately. One of the pamphlets showed an astronaut tucked inside a cramped mock space capsule. And the text below explained that astronauts had to get used to spending many long hours without being able to move. Mark decided to set a record for sitting still in a cramped space. He was sure this would get NASA's attention. He found a cardboard box that he could barely fit into. He drew buttons and gauges all over the inside of it and outfitted it with a blanket, a thermometer, an alarm clock, and a periscope made with two of his mother's compact mirrors. He set up the space photos from NASA against the wall so he could look at them through the periscope and imagine himself on a real mission. 7-year-old Mark Salzman began his program by sitting in the box for half an hour and increased his time every day by adding 10 minutes. After a week or so, when he felt his determination waning, he started to point the box towards the television so he could watch through the periscope to counteract the boredom. He did this for several weeks, building up to over 3 hours per mission before the training came to an abrupt end one afternoon. That day, the alarm clock indicated he had been inside for 3 hours and 5 minutes. Suddenly, he heard a pop and felt himself shift in position. Another pop, but this was a little longer in duration and sounded more like something tearing. One of the taped seams of the cardboard box was opening. If it got any wider, the 7-year-old would lose all his air pressure in his space shuttle. His body would inflate like a balloon, then freeze in the absolute vacuum of space. "Mayday, mayday," he shouted, "Mission Control, we have a problem." "Mark, honey," his mother said, "I'm teaching now." Someone else said, "Where did that voice come from, Mrs. Salzman?" "Oh, from that box over there near the TV. My son's in it." Young Mark turned the periscope around and saw, instead of the earth or the moon or the limitless void, he saw his mother giving a piano lesson in the living room, and her student was sitting on the bench staring in his direction. "He's practicing to be an astronaut," his mother explained in a stage whisper. "He puts those pictures of the stars in front of the box and looks at them through the little periscope. He's been doing it for weeks." She looked towards her son. "Mark, I think your box is starting to fall apart. Your rear end is sticking out." Her student giggled. Mark's butt had popped out of the spaceship right in front of one of his mother's teenage piano students. He pulled the toy periscope down, climbed out through the top, and carefully avoided looking at either his mother or her student. His face was red. He went upstairs to his room, laid down on the bed, and went into a black fog, which he descended into whenever he came out of an outstanding daydream and realized that he was still a little kid in Connecticut. Perhaps one or more of these stories has stirred memories of your own childhood. Like Frank McCord, perhaps you recall your own mother rushing to help when you or one of your brothers or sisters were injured. Like Tobias Wolff, perhaps you recall getting your mother to do you favors when she was vulnerable. Like Elaine Simpson, perhaps you recall your mother struggling to help you in school. Like Russell Baker, perhaps you recall watching your mother argue with other adults in the family. Like Annie Dillard, perhaps you recall your mother's use of humor. Like Mark Salzman, perhaps you recall your mother embarrassing you in front of a stranger. None of these mothers was perfect, but each of them did their best. And this is what real families are like. Children accidentally cut themselves. Children exploit mothers when mothers have weak moments. Mothers want their children to do well in school but do not always know how to help them. Mothers have arguments in front of their children. Mothers make sarcastic jokes that children do not always understand. And mothers embarrass us in front of others. Still, most moms are good enough mothers. In spite of their imperfections, they convey their love in 1,000 ways. Remember a hug and a kiss when they put us down to bed at night. Remember those meals they prepared each day so we would not go hungry. Remember the words of thanks when we brought home a small gift that we made at school for Mother's Day. Remember a look of pride when we passed the eighth grade or passed high school or college. Remember a smile when, after we left home, we returned for a visit. We remember these moments and we celebrate our imperfect mothers, our good enough mothers. If they're still living at this time of year, we say thanks to them and we hope that they are pleased with their very imperfect children.